Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is painter, artist, and teacher Kim Schrag. Schrag is a graduate of the University of Kansas at Lawrence, Kansas, and Cornell University, where she received her MFA in painting. Her work has been shown at many regional galleries, including George Waters Gallery at Elmira College, State of the Art in Ithaca, Oxford Gallery in Rochester, and State University Plaza Gallery in Albany. For over 20 years, she has taught drawing and design at Tompkins Cortland Community College, and she's also been in collaboration with artist and photographer Fernando Llosa for over 20 years. They have a blog called Unbound Art. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I want to know, because you have said that you grew up on a farm in Kansas, mm-hmm. how a little farm girl found out about and got attached to art.
Well, you know, it's hard to say where all of these things come from, but when I was about 5 years old, my mother took up painting, and I was transfixed by it. I loved seeing the color. I liked seeing this image emerge, and she wasn't a painter much more than that just brief time period, 1 year. That she was painting, but sometimes she'd pick it up over the years. But I think that it was always something that I liked to do, you know, and there were paintings, reproductions of paintings in our house. And because it was in the society, you know, it was being talked about. I went to museums and, you know, it was around.
So you caught the bug, though.
I caught the bug early.
That's fascinating to me. So you grew up in the 60s, you know, and there was a lot of cultural upheaval, wars, posters, protests. Did that affect your transition into taking your art seriously? How did that affect you?
I hadn't thought about it that way. I think art was part of that whole movement of transition, and mm-hmm. art was changing, and art was becoming bold and bright, and it was young, and it was exciting, you know. So I'm sure that it was part of the whole cultural movement that just made me feel like this was my generation.
Yeah. The art scene in the 60s was really great.
Yes,
I remember it too, of course. Now, what mediums did you start working with? I assume you've been painting ever since you were a little kid.
Right.
What mediums did you start working in? Because we obviously know you've transitioned into all kinds of experimental stuff, but what did you start out with?
Well, I think, you know, crayons, the beginning, and then watercolors and oil paints and drawing. All of those things were, you know, they were traditional in a way. They were available, so.
Uh-huh. And I assume that you continued to pursue art in high school and then obviously mm-hmm. went on to college. But what was happening in high school with your art? Were you experimenting then?
Our high school had a really dynamic program, actually. Mm. We had two art teachers, and they taught everything from ceramic and jewelry making to painting and drawing and printmaking. So it was kind of like my focus in high school. I was there a lot. It was my place to hang out, and the art teacher encouraged us to be in the room and kind of treat it like a club. So that was, it kind of gathered me to thinking this is the direction I'll go.
So you got encouragement all through your life, it sounds like.
I did, yes.
That really is fascinating to me. Amazing. Now, you eventually left Kansas mm-hmm. and went to New York. And so tell us how that changed your view and helped you to grow, perhaps, as an artist.
Well, when I first left Kansas, part of the reason for leaving Kansas was I left Kansas with my boyfriend who was going to Syracuse University, and he was traveling toward the East Coast, and I thought this is the place that I should go, to the East Coast or to the West Coast, but because that was available, thought New York City, you know, people who are artists, they have to go to New York City,
yeah.
So I eventually thought that I would end up there, and I did, and I spent some time, a semester in New York City before I went to Cornell, and that gave me advantage, I think, of seeing all the galleries and seeing the museums and spending time in the city and having a studio in the city and seeing a lot of artists working there. And that gave me a feeling of what it was like to be in that particular kind of world.
So it wasn't overwhelming to you. I've talked to other artists who say the New York experience freaked me out.
Yes, I was very young. So, you know, I was 21, 22 years old, and it was just what I wanted to do. It seemed like the most impressive, exciting thing that I could do at that time. I don't think I could do it now, but
yeah.
I could do it then.
Yeah. Oh, of course. That's the epitome. It's the art yeah. central, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. Now, you use the word experiment a lot in a lot of your narratives when you talk about your art.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by experiment? Just for your own expression or to tell us how that was navigated in regard to you looking for some way to communicate,
mm-hmm.
obviously.
Right. Well, a lot of experimentation has to do with materials. And, You know, and for me, it's like play. It's like saying, well, let's try this just to see what happens. And if I have an idea in mind and I say, let's start here, and whatever happens will then lead me on to the next thing. And it's a kind of growing process to see what will come out. I think the other part of it in terms of not just materials but also content is to say to myself, I want to go in this direction. Let me see what I want to do. For example, in the last few years, I've been working with the figure more in my work. And that was not something that I had done for a long, long time, not since school. And I didn't feel very comfortable with it. So I said, well, what I'll do in order to get more comfortable with the idea of putting the figure in the work is to use sketchbooks. And I'm going to start working with a sketchbook. And every night I'll draw something that has to do with the figure in the sketchbook. And I found that it was just starting to work with the idea of the human being and what the human being was. And it was coming out not because I was saying, you know, you're going to draw something that looks like this or has this theme, but the human element would just tell me something back. Wow. And so it was a kind of growing process where I felt like, okay, now I don't really like these images in the beginning. They're really stiff. They're really clunky. But as I went, they took on their own style. And they also started speaking back to me about a lot of the interests I have in the human being, the human condition, the human psychology.
Wow. So you say that you were uncomfortable with it at first, but you felt drawn to pursue it, though.
Right.
Why do you think that was? Was it a new way to communicate more with the outer world instead of just trying to express emotions like so many painters
do?
Well,
a lot of my work before that had been abstract, and I felt like I was always working with the with psychological concepts, and I would title my works according to those psychological concepts. But like Fernando would say, you know, somebody looks at that and they're not going to get that because they'll just see the abstract image, even if you put the title on. So while it was so very real to me that what I was portraying was what I was thinking, it wasn't necessarily obvious to other people. So I thought, okay, I have to get the human being into the picture. It has to be a representation of the human being in order for other humans to identify and understand the concept.
So that
was the intention.
You know, I have talked to a lot of artists who don't really want to put elaborate titles on their paintings because they want people to decide what they're about. How do you feel about that? It sounds like without the title, people wouldn't have known what your intent was.
Yeah, I think my intent is important, and I think that I'm trying not just to put out an image, but I'm trying to talk to people about what I'm concerned about, what interests me, and so I'm being a little pushy. I'm saying, yes, this is what I'm intending. This is what this is pointing to, this image is pointing to, and so I want to give you titles. I want to give you a pointer as to what it is that you might find in that image if I direct you.
Yeah. Well, you do say that you're trying to portray the human condition, explore it, probably dissect it in some ways. And, of course, I would think you'd want to point people to that. They could still say, oh, that's not what it looks like to me.
What a
strange way to title it, you know.
Yeah.
So talk to us about some of these mediums that you have tried. I'm really interested in plaster. You've painted on plaster, and the result is absolutely beautiful from what I've seen.
Thank you.
I've only seen them on your website. What did plaster talk to you about? What was that?
Well, I've always had an interest in textural surfaces. I like the way things feel. I like real objects. And so plaster was a way for me to control the surface of the painting before I even started painting on the surface.
Because it seems to me you'd be out of control because it's already set there for you. You can't really manipulate it.
Right. Well, what happens is that I create a mold, whereas I already make the image out of layered mat board. So it's a multi-layered surface to begin with, and then I put a frame around that collage base, and then I pour the plaster on top of it so the plaster picks up the image that was in the collage base.
Wow.
And so when I peel those two things apart, the collage base and the plaster, I just have a white plaster slab, but it has the image in it. and then I can add color to that.
So you do have more control. Mm-hmm.
I do have a lot of control.
I get it. Well, what about creased paper? I noticed mm-hmm. that you did a series with creased paper. Mm-hmm. You painted over it.
Right, right.
Same kind of manipulation?
Creased paper was a way of getting away from plaster but keeping the plaster surface. Plaster has some limitations. It can be fragile. It can be heavy. It has to be framed. And I was trying to come up with another surface that didn't have to be framed. And so in order to do the creased paper, I would just fold paper, crease it, refold it, sometimes cut it up, reconstruct it, and then make this surface that could be painted on top of.
Were you always happy with some of these experiments? Or,
no,
or are there a bunch
I didn't
of
keep all of them. Or they get recycled back into something else. Sure. I mean, it takes a while to figure out what's going to work and what's not. And the first few are exciting, but they're not necessarily the ones that you're going to show later.
Yeah. I'm also fascinated by the oil on board that you did, and you also started using lettering and words and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How did that start happening in your life? Visual artists using words is always, I've always been pretty interested mm-hmm. in that.
Yeah, I think that words are kind of like titles. You know, I mean, they become part of the piece. So this is a way of even pushing that further, that instead of being on the outside of the piece, it starts becoming inside of the piece, and the word becomes part of the image. Uh-huh. The word becomes image within image.
Yeah. Some of your paintings almost look like you've got people in prisons and isolated. And tell us what your thinking is around that. To me, it almost seems political.
Mm-hmm.
But is it based on something that you have experienced as a teacher? Or
right. Well, I would love to know which images you're thinking of in this case. But I think that isolation is a theme as in the human being, that we all feel isolated. We feel like we're not understood, or we can't communicate, or that we're conditioned to think and act in a certain way. And that is an isolating kind of controlling situation. I use the grid a lot, and I think the grid is that symbol for thought, for conditioning, for being within a certain system.
Now, I want to talk about your personal and artistic relationship with Fernando.
Sure.
Fernando Llosa. Tell us about it, because I have had so many artists on who say they like to work in isolation. They expected to be sort of isolated as artists. How has this collaboration come about, and what has it done to enhance your work?
Yes. Well, we both work separately on our work, but we also, because we live together, we talk every day. We see each other's work. We both have studios in our home. And, you know, when we first got to know each other, we were at Handwork, and we were both doing different things. He was doing stone poems, and I was doing dyed fabric, and also still painting. But we would see each other's work, so we would talk about it. But I think the bigger collaboration has always been in dialogue.
Mm.
We talk about the ideas that are interesting to us about the human condition and the world, and how that comes into the work. And so, because that dialogue is always going on, and we're always seeing the work, it's just natural to that we're really in tune with each other's process. We did do some collaborative work together, a couple of oil paintings and some drawings together.
Yeah.
And that was a very focused project, in that we knew that we wanted to do large-scale oil paintings together. Fernando hadn't done large-scale oil paintings. I had done some, so I said, well, let's do this together. And so we started out just taking turns, 15 minutes each.
Wow.
On the painting. At first, it was totally abstract. We didn't know what we were going to do. And then an image started emerging, and we were able to just keep it going, knowing that it didn't matter what really happened with the painting. It would be okay, because we were both working on it together, and it would go in its own place.
And I saw some of those paintings. They're beautiful.
Thank you.
They almost look like Escher paintings. They're kind of mathematical. Or
yes,
they look like geometry.
There's a lot going on,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Kim Schrag. She's a painter, artist, and teacher, and we're talking about her work and her collaboration. Is there anything else you want to talk about in regard to Fernando? It seems to me you guys are in dialogue about the state of the world,
mm-hmm.
too, which obviously affects your paintings, right?
We are, yeah. That's a daily conversation, and it's been a really exciting conversation, because it just never seems to end, and it never seems to get boring. I think other people listening to us might not agree, but for us, there's a kind of intensity to this conversation that just keeps picking up and it keeps transforming. And it goes in a number of different directions, the world, our own psychology, who we are as human beings, what is our responsibility in the world, you know, what is the responsibility of the individual when they see the condition of the world, and what does art do in that context. Mm. So all of these topics are ongoing for us, and I think it's just been, I feel so lucky to have had that conversation.
Yeah, put it down on paper, too, and it sounds like something that would be valuable for everybody.
Right.
Else. Do you guys work as each other's critics, too? I mean, does Fernando say, Kim, that doesn't work?
Yeah. Well, yeah, he was just in my studio about an hour ago saying, well, this is what I think about these paintings. And, you know, and so, you know, it's good because, you know, I trust him. I trust what he says. I don't have to do what he says, but I do trust him. So it is good always to have some, you know, just a reaction to what's going on in the
world. Yeah, and you critique his stuff,
too. I do critique his work, too,
I would give
him suggestions as to color and, you know, cropping and things like that.
But, how do you feel as an artist about having to take on the role of doing your own PR, doing promotions? A lot of artists have told me they're really reluctant, and it's been really kind of a scary new endeavor that they're expected to do. How do you feel about it?
I think that's my weakness. I don't think that I do it very well. I mean, it is something that maybe you learn over the years what you can do, but it also feels very elusive. It never quite works the way that you want it to, or maybe I'm just not that interested in doing it, and so I don't do it as I should.
I think it would be hard to sell yourself.
Yes, it is.
I mean, you work so quietly and in such an intellectual fashion, and then you have to go out into the commercial world and go, come look at my colors.
Yeah, it's a whole different way of thinking and relating to people that you don't know, and so it's easier to be in the studio.
Yeah. Now, I want to bring this up because in one of your narratives, and I find this really, really fascinating, I want to explore it with you. You said that you followed a path of interest, practiced your craft, but that in middle age, I'm finally abandoning the idealized future in which I proved myself to be extraordinary. This was something you wrote before for a show. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that. And then you went on to say that I have this new awareness that I may have missed the all-encompassing importance of life itself by insisting that human worth, my worth, is defined by exceptional talent exhibited through a successful career. Mm. Let's explore this. I think a lot of people are feeling that now.
Oh, good.
I have heard that from people.
Yeah.
I'm wasting my time looking for fame, you know?
Right.
To tell me where that came from.
Oh, I think that's so interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. I think that we're really pushed in this culture to be successful, to prove that we have something to give and to show that we are talented and that we're exceptional and that we should step on stage. But I think that stepping on stage just focuses your emphasis on your actor role.
Mm.
And then you forget what the context of where we are is, which is life, and that life is already here in all its abundance and all its dimensions, and I think we've lost our appreciation for it. And then there's the other side, which is saying, because I'm not so successful as an actor on stage, I feel badly. You know, I feel like I've let myself down. I've let those who thought that I was going to be great down. And I just can't live up to that level that I thought I would get to. So then there's the feelings of anxiety and frustration and maybe even depression over that. And when I step out of that, I said, wow, there's something else here that is so much more important than that role of the individual. And I think that's what I'm trying to get back to.
Yeah.
I'm really taking a step back to saying, you know, doing art is something that I do, but it's not something I have to be. I don't have to be an artist.
Yeah.
But I want to be a being. I want to be something that is part of a totality, part of the universal that's here.
Yeah.
And so that
knitting
to me,
yourself into the whole piece.
Yeah, it's almost like I have to go back and just dismantle this artistic persona in order to give that a chance.
Do you think that's cultural? Do you think that's a primarily American obsession in some ways?
You know, I don't know. I'm sure it's an American obsession, but I'm not well traveled around the world, so I couldn't tell you how other cultures present themselves or condition. But I think that any time there's a lot of emphasis on money, then this is going to happen.
Yeah. And fame and mm-hmm. you know, accolades, they're so fleeting.
Right.
Because people still have to go back to a real life, was
That's
it?
Right.
Which is exactly what your full circle seems to have been. I'm going to miss out on the whole shebang if I start projecting that I'm supposed to be on the big stage.
That's right.
I find that really interesting. And you just came upon this in the recent years, right? You said in middle age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, when I was going to school and then graduate school and then trying to use what I had learned, I felt like I really had to push myself in that direction. But life kept coming back in, and I had a daughter, you know, and I was living in a more rural area, and there weren't that many opportunities. And so a lot of it wasn't working for me to be successful. Highly successful in, you know,
I was
going to
say, you are successful,
way.
Kim. You right. are successful.
But, you know, in terms of getting a lot of awards or big gallery shows or any of that, that's really hasn't happened. I'm basically a local person, which is fine. But it did make me question who I was and what was really important. And I think that it slowly started coming in that there were other things that were going on that I needed to pay attention to.
Yeah, yeah. I find that you can touch people in a deeper way in these kinds of environments. You really can. Mm-hmm. Because, the thought of touching people in the way the Kardashians say, I mean,
right.
it's nothing. It's absolutely water,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
And here you have people coming up to you, people buying your art, people talking, saying you've moved them. I mean, uh-huh. at least everybody I know in our small community uh-huh. who is in the arts has said at one time or another, you've touched somebody,
yeah.
right? Let's talk a little bit about your teaching uh-huh. and your experiences. I know you teach at TC3, but you've mm-hmm. also taught kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I am mm-hmm. absolutely in love with kids'
oh,
art.
Oh, great.
Tell us about how do you motivate them and inspire them.
Oh, well, I've stopped teaching kids for about 5 years, but I was teaching kids for 23 years. And, you know, I think it's so interesting to teach kids because you can work with materials and you can open up almost any topic to them. It's a great thing to have in the school system because you can work with any subject matter, and you can say, oh, how do we make images? You know, how do we communicate with images? And kids are so receptive. They love to work with materials, and if you give them an idea and you show them some examples, you know, they're ready to go. They're just so eager.
Yeah, and they don't censor themselves.
No, they don't. They don't really censor them. I think that they're natural in that they're so responsive. And, you know, they already, some of them don't like what they do. But, you know, you can still push them to try. And I think they're always surprised at the results.
Yeah. Kids art is amazing. Kids art and poetry
mm-hmm. yeah.
is what I'm in. What about your teaching with adults and teaching at TC3? I'm still so happy that the arts are alive and well in so many communities, although, the funding is dwindling.
Mm-hmm.
To tell us about inspiration for the adults.
Well, TC3, I teach drawing and design, and in drawing, I take an approach where we do some drawing from observation. We also do some drawing from the imagination. We talk about composition. It's a basic introduction to drawing, so I don't expect anybody to know anything. Some people come with more background experience than others, but for them, I think that everybody who goes through the classes really feels like they learn a lot. They start to understand the vocabulary of drawing and what is possible. So drawing is just for me, it's a really easy and feels like such a personal endeavor to kind of move into it. My design classes are also really basic. Starting out with very basic conceptual information, talking about line, shape, color, value, texture, composition. My Design 2 class, we do 8 weeks of color exercises and 8 weeks of 3D exercises. So it's really accessible to anybody that wants to come in and get a basic vocabulary, a basic understanding of what, how to think about images and how to take them apart, how to analyze them.
Yeah, and you've—I mean, it seems to me you have to have a real background to be able to teach this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, you need to be an artist, I think, in order to teach it, because what you've already done is going to be given to them, given to the students. The thing that's interesting about TC3 is it also has such a wide range of students. It has kids that are right out of high school, and then it has people who are coming back who are maybe in their 40s and 50s, 60s to come back. And it's an interesting combination to have that population together.
Yeah.
And it's great for me when the older students come back, too, because I really feel like we can communicate.
Oh, I love that. And the generations need to talk to each other.
That's right.
We do. I mean, we're still living through it.
And
then we have to leave it to them.
Yeah.
What would you say to people who want to pursue a career in art, now that you've come to this middle-aged conclusion that you don't have to push yourself to try to be Peter Max or somebody who's really famous?
Yeah, well, I think that I don't know. I don't know if I'm the best person to talk about having a career in art, because I don't know that I would be so encouraging in terms of just you can go out and make a living. I think that I would tell them that that if you really want to be an artist, you'll work very hard at learning how to be an artist, just to learn what you want to say, learn how to control the materials, putting on shows and so on. But you may also really need to find another way of making money. And I know that not everybody has to. Some people are able to produce their work and sell it and make a living, but I think it's extremely difficult. And then you have the problem of trying to balance being an artist and having enough time to really create the work and give it the attention it needs, plus you're dividing your time with making a living. And those two things are hard to do.
Yeah. What do you say about the importance of the arts in the community? Is it, we go back to what I was just saying, that a lot of places are cutting funding.
Right. Well, I've always thought it was important, and I've always enjoyed it. I love looking at art. I love looking at the way people express their worlds, their worldview. We communicate with art, so I think if you cut art back, you're cutting out one of those avenues of communication. And I think we need to find new ways of expressing what is happening in the world. And if we do it artistically and that grabs people and they're willing to pay attention in a way that they aren't willing to just listen to the news, then I think that's important.
Yeah. Well, Kim Schrag, we're almost out of time. Any upcoming shows where we can see your work? And we also could use some contact information.
Oh, okay. Well, I am showing at Rasa Spa right now through February.
Nice.
I will be at Windsor Whipworks Art Center in Windsor, New York next September. And another show at Yates County Art Center in Penn Yan in May.
Oh, great.
Contact information, I have a website, www.kimschrag.com, and probably my email will be there, too.
Yeah, you can get in touch with her. Well, Kim Schrag, thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love your work. Everybody go to her website, go check it out, and go to some of these shows. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.